You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of May, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we're joined by James Schneider from Think Africa Press to get the day's news agenda. What have you got for us, James?
That Africa has lost $1.4 trillion over the last 30 years, which is a lot of money from illicit outflows. The Ugandan police have stopped their siege of the country's leading newspaper. And the South African rand continues to slide among mining fears and a badly received speech from President Zuma.
Then it's Birkins at dawn, everyone's favorite, including Emma's. Did LVMH employ dirty tricks to take over its arch rival Hermes? A French hearing decides today.
I have a soft spot for the Kelly too. Plus, after years of Hollywood turning all bashful, we ask if sex is making a comeback to our screens. Avert your ears now, Phil.
Sex isn't going to come back like it was in the 80s because we have a different attitude toward it now. It's no longer mysterious. It's something that we want to still see, but we want to see it in a different kind of context.
And that definitely does sound quite risque. We'll ask also why nations that cook more are slimmer.
You find, if you look at the statistics for the rise in obesity, it very closely tracks the decline in home cooking. And the reason for that is that corporations who cook for us today don't cook very well.
And we'll be hearing more from the author Michael Holland just a little later on. All that, plus we'll play you some great music too. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
So lots to come up on the show, including handbags and a bit of sex. How can you go wrong with that? But before all that, here is...
Our newsreader Barney Burnham has started to go into convulsions.
Before that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Are you all right, Barney?
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Russian, US and UN officials are to meet next week to discuss ways to bring the warring sides in Syria together for a peace conference. The meeting, proposed by Washington and Moscow, is under threat as the different factions lay down demands before talks take place. US and UK officials are investigating unconfirmed reports that an American woman and a British man have been killed in Syria. Syrian state TV has shown footage of what are apparently the bodies and identity cards of Westerners killed by government troops while fighting for rebels in the northwest of the country. The woman's family says the FBI has informed them of her death, naming her as Nicole Mansfield, a 33-year-old Muslim convert from the town of Flint, Michigan. Meanwhile, Syria's opposition leaders meeting in Istanbul have agreed to add 14 named members of a liberal bloc and 15 Free Syrian Army members to the 60-member assembly of the Syrian National Coalition. George Sabra is the SNC's acting chairman.
Let me tell you frankly, we have a plan for them for more than a month to add some members of Free Syrian Army to our coalition. And we are in touch with them every day. So we know exactly what they think, and also they know exactly our position for that. Now they are a part of our coalition.
Authorities in the United States say they've intercepted a threatening letter addressed to President Obama, similar to ones recently sent to the New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Those letters contain material believed to be the deadly poison ricin. A Secret Service official said the White House letter was similar but did not elaborate. The European Union has agreed to put an end to decades of overfishing and rebuild dwindling stocks by 2020. It's part of a deal to overhaul the bloc's fisheries policy. The agreement will put an end to annual haggling over catch quotas by EU ministers in Brussels, widely blamed for putting short-term economic interests above the long-term health of European fish stocks. Maria Damanaki is the EU Commissioner for Fisheries.
We are going to stop discarding. We are going to stop catching fish from the sea and then throw it back dead, as we are doing till now. And we are going to stop other wasteful practices.
A team of researchers trying to solve the mystery of the aviator Amelia Earhart's disappearance in 1937 say a sonar image taken from just beyond the shore of a remote Pacific island could be a piece of wreckage from her plane. The team from the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery has been conducting an expedition on the island of Nikumaroro in the Republic of Kiribati, searching for Earhart's plane. A forensic imaging specialist said the image could represent a wing or part of the fuselage. Earhart and her navigator disappeared after leaving Papua New Guinea on July 2, 1937, in an attempt to fly around the world along an equatorial route. A 13-year-old boy from Bayside Hills, New York, has won the Scripps National Spelling Bee by correctly spelling knadle, a kind of dumpling. Arvind Mahankali, a student at Nathaniel Hawthorne Middle School, had finished third in the contest twice before, each time stumbling on German words. This year, he saw off his demons when he nailed knadle, which comes from German-derived Yiddish, and he spoke to ESPN after his victory.
It means that I am retiring on a good note.
He's retiring, folks. What are you going to do now that you're retired?
I shall spend the summer, maybe the entire day, studying, like, physics.
Don't let it get to your head, lad. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. If ever a child was asking for a fat lip, that's one of them. How do you spell
knadle? Do either of you know how to spell knadle?
Well,
I've got it here. It's K-N-A-I-D-E-L.
A-I-D-E-L. Yeah. That's clearly mixed up with Yiddish.
It's derived from knödel is the German one.
Which is K-N-O, umlaut.
A friend of mine is called Knödelsdorfer.
Little dumpling
Noodle
villager.
Villager.
Little dumpling villager.
Yeah.
And are they?
No, I wouldn't describe her as that.
Barney, our own Knödeldorfer, will be back at 30 minutes past the hour to bring us the latest from the world. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是Monaco 24.
Oplondo, du Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. The time is 9:07 in Cape Town. It is 8:07 here in London, which means it's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today is James Schneider. He's the editor of Think Africa Press. James, thanks for coming into the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've chosen a couple stories for us, but let's perhaps a bit of a surprising one here.
Yeah, so my first story is that Africa is a net creditor to the rest of the world. Africa has essentially been subsidizing the rest of the world by, there's a new report out from the African Development Bank, which says somewhere in the region of $1.4 trillion has left the continent in illicit outflows between 1980 and 2009. $1.4 trillion, which is the equivalent to the entire continent's annual GDP.
It is a very leaky ship. Where is the money going? Or where is it where is the money coming from and where is the money going to?
It's coming here, and it is...
Not to Midori House, though.
Not to Midori House, maybe kind of 2 miles the other
way. I
don't
know, I saw a van outside.
Marked Congo. That's one of the places coming. It's coming... Nigeria is the biggest victim or worst offender, depending how you view it. It's lost something like $250 billion... in illicit outflows, generally linked to oil, and the beneficiaries are tax havens, Western companies, and so on. I mean, a lot of the money does end up swishing around in London.
And this figure, $1.4 trillion, doesn't even include other illicit activities, including drug trafficking, smuggling.
Exactly. So this is the money that you can sort of estimate because it ends up in a bank account somewhere. It leaves illegally and then it ends up in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands or somewhere, but you can't necessarily track whose it is because of banking secrecy and beneficial ownership and so on. But then, yes, if you add in all sorts of other black market activities, people smuggling, then it becomes larger. But I think the reason why those things should be separated is one is kind of pure criminal activity, which is not necessarily kind of structural in terms of the global economy, whilst this extraction of the 1.4 trillion is structural.
It's entirely structural, isn't it? And we've got the G8 meetings next month where the issues of tax evasion, tax avoidance will be, and banking secrecy will be discussed. And I think perhaps there's a common perception that that is a problem that does not necessarily affect Africa. But clearly, as you have just explained, it very most definitely does. A great problem with this is the implementation of regulation across the board. Mm-hmm. How on earth do you go about addressing this problem?
Well, I mean, in Britain, we're in a particularly privileged situation in that we control a large number of the world's tax havens and banking secrecy zones. And I mean, I think that personally, it becomes quite a moral issue and that governments need to at some point say, right, well, we're going to start changing the regulations rather than saying, oh, well, you know, it's very difficult. We need to do this on a global scale, et cetera. I mean, Britain could start. Britain is starting to try to lead the way. And other countries should do so. I think a tide has turned in what people think about corporation tax, about corporate power and about banking secrecy. And you can kind of see this across the board. It's no longer a kind of fringe NGO left-wing issue where, you know, mainstream economists and even the British government are supporting it.
Sorry.
And staying, in Africa, to Uganda, the leading newspaper there, the Daily Monitor, has finally reopened after being shut down by police for 11 days. It's a story we covered here on Midori House last week, but bring us up to date.
So the police have ended the siege yesterday. Owners and senior editors of the Daily Monitor came to some sort of agreement with the government, and they said that national security is a no-go area, and that they showed them their editorial guidelines and they'll be sticking to those very firmly, and they're not to do anything which kind of stirs up any trouble. This is all comes from a letter which the newspaper published, which is from a four-star general who's now kind of in hiding in London, called David Sejusa, which says that Museveni, the president, is trying to put his son as his successor in 2016, and anyone who opposes it risks assassination.
Now, the government has said that the paper has reopened, but that the owners highly regretted the story.
Yeah, so from reading the newspaper's own accounts and the government's account this morning, there's a slight difference. The government is saying, look, they're really sorry, they're really upset what they've done, they're going to stick to their guidelines would not allow them to publish things like this. And the Monitor has said, well, you know, this is a victory for common sense. It's not a victory for us, but it's a victory for common sense. It's definitely not a victory for the government. And they've said, we're just sticking to our previous guidelines. We just showed them our previous guidelines, and they're happy with that. They're saying they've given no concessions.
Long term, it doesn't seem to be a victory for press freedom in Uganda.
No, not at all.
Where is this going to go?
Well, there is one small victory for press freedom, but the reason why the paper was closed for so long is that the government were demanding access to the letter that had been leaked, and the newspaper refused to give it to them. They said press freedom, and they went to court to prevent them from doing this. And, you know, that little sign, and also the fact that there was large protest, the fact that this was a deeply unpopular act in Kampala, helped strengthen the kind of case for the free press. But obviously, when we're told national security is a no-go area, anything to do with succession is a no-go area, it doesn't look very good for politics in a country which has never seen a peaceful transfer of power.
And some bad news out of South Africa. Their currency there, the rand, is continuing its slide downwards. Zuma saying just yesterday that he has real concerns over the economy of South Africa. How worried should the rest of the world be?
Reasonably. I mean, so yesterday the rand slid 3% against the dollar, basically on the back of a speech Zuma gave. Zuma gave a speech which was meant to reassure the world about the state of the South African economy. And the problem is, which is the problem for a lot of South African politicians, he said reasonably well what all the problems were and not that much on what they're doing to sort it out. And when that was coupled with news of a wildcat strike at some chromium mines owned by Glencore, this really ruffled the markets. And so the slide continued. It's now 10% this month that the rand has fallen against the dollar. This is a real problem because with the currency sliding, interest rates can't be cut. And interest rates need to be cut in order to boost the economy, but they're stuck at 5%.
James, we're going to have to leave it there. James Schneider, the editor of Think Africa Press, many thanks for coming on the show. Coming up, it's the latest chapter in the ongoing war of the luxury brands, and this time it's getting very, very nasty indeed.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavors on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are two-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes, and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn. On film, on monocle.com.
It's 9:16 a.m. in Paris, 8:16 here at Midori House in London. Now, LVMH and Hermès have long been at war. Although Hermès is already part-owned by its rival, a little over a fifth, it still remains the last late great luxury prize. Both sides have fought bitterly, they've fought cleanly, and they've got their hands dirty too. But today, Friday, the latest chapter in their ongoing feud could be concluded by France's stock market regulator.
It will be argued that LVMH went on a secret mission to grab a stake in Hermès. LVMH, which has countered this claim with a defamation lawsuit, furiously denies this, saying its intentions were nothing but friendly. There is nothing friendly, however, about the stage which both parties have reached. Well, we caught up with Shehrazad Dinescu, the FT's correspondent in Paris, just before she headed out to the tribunal. So it's the end of a two-year-long investigation into this. What can we expect? What will the outcome likely be?
Well, what we're going to hear today is that the sanctions committee of the stock market regulator is meeting in public to hear the LVMH's defense in this case. And at the end of the day, I'm afraid we're not going to actually get a decision because the sanctions committee is going to go away and think about it. And we probably won't hear what their decision is until the summer, until probably July. But the most we can expect probably is a financial penalty, and that's only if they uphold the findings of the regulator itself. They may dismiss them entirely.
Shehrazad, LVMH have countered these claims with a defamation lawsuit. Tell us about that.
Yes. In fact, as soon as Hermès launched its legal complaint against LVMH, LVMH also counter-complained for blackmail, actually, amongst other things, and slander. So LVMH, Bernard Arnault, they're very well known to be an extremely litigious company, and that shows that they're going to that they're taking this extremely seriously and are really going to fight to the end.
Tell us a little bit more about these findings and the action of LVMH's Bernard Arnault.
Well, what I would say is that it's actually not been made public yet, but we've had some information that's sort of guided us really to what the substance of the matter is, which is basically that LVMH acquired a very large shareholding in Hermès pretty much overnight. It acquired 17%, and normally you have to declare when you go above a 5% threshold. So this is basically what the AMF has been looking at to see whether any stock market rules were breached. What LVMH did was that it used derivatives in order to build up that position, and there was actually a loophole in the French law allowing them to do that. So the regulator is actually looking more at sort of timing issues of the declaration and things like that. But nevertheless, if they uphold some of the findings, it'll be a reputational blow, I would say, for LVMH.
Absolutely, and Arnault and his company at LVMH have long tried to get Hermès. It's always been in his sights. How damaging, as you mentioned, will this potentially be for the reputation of LVMH?
It all depends really on exactly what they decide to uphold and how big a sanction they decide to impose, if they impose a sanction. Even then, this is not in any way a criminal case. It would be a case of violating some stock market rules, but it wouldn't have any kind of criminal penalties or anything like that attached to it. But what I would say is that Hermès has separately filed a case against LVMH in the law courts as well. So even after the resolution of the stock market regulators' inquiry, we're going to have a long-running legal case by Hermès against LVMH.
How desired a prize is Hermès?
Well, Hermès really is regarded as the most exclusive, the most wonderful bag. The Birkin bag, the Kelly bag are sort of iconic names, really, in the industry. And these ones are handmade, usually by one craftsman. So they're very, very exclusive indeed. And Hermès itself, therefore, is regarded really as a jewel of a company. It's a very old company. It's been around for nearly 200 years.
Arnaud, he's worth something like $29 billion. If this does get upheld, it'll be a very small fine, relatively speaking, about 10 million euros. Is that just a tiny sum that he needs to pay? But it's in his mind, at least, it's extremely worth it.
Well, the fine, of course, would be absolutely nothing to him. But the fine, of course, would relate to the way in which these shares were taken. Quite a separate matter. The issue of taking over Hermès is a separate matter because, in fact, Hermès, it's family controlled and it's structured in such a way that a takeover would be very, very difficult indeed. Though what most people think is that having positioned himself with a 17% share, should the Hermès family or some members of the family in the future wish to sell out, that Bernard Arnault and LVMH would be in pole position to then take it over, but they're not in a position to take over the company now with its present structure.
And Shahrazad, Phil mentioned the potential toxicity of this to LVMH, but when you now think of Hermès and LVMH, you no longer think of two separate brands, you think of two houses at war with each other. How long and how damaging do you think this conflict is?
It depends entirely on how what the outcome is and how many public statements are made. I mean, you can see that LVMH is actually very, very mindful of its reputation and doesn't like the fact by any means that they've been spurned by the Hermès family. But the Hermès family is furious that LVMH took this 17% shareholding without their knowledge. So particularly in the sort of luxury corridors, you know, in lobby groups and things like that within the industry, it has cast something of a shadow. And it does look like it's going to be a very long run battle indeed.
And that was Emma and myself talking with Shahrazad Dinescu, the FT's correspondent in Paris, a little earlier. And you can catch up with the latest from the tribunal on The Briefing, which is at midday London time today. Welcome back. You're with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, as cooking shows on television have become more popular than ever, we've actually started spending less time in the kitchen ourselves. This is something that's got author, journalist, and professor Michael Pollan worried. He has been looking at the revolution of processed food and has done his maths.
It appears that nations who cook more are slimmer. And this is not the only reason why he's convinced that we should simply cook more ourselves at home. His findings have sparked Mr. Pollan to write a book called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He joined Marcus Hippie in the studio for this week's edition of The Menu. Here's a little taster.
You know, there are many things in our lives that we no longer do, that we've outsourced to corporations. You know, we don't fix our cars anymore. We don't make our clothing anymore. And we haven't looked back. We're very happy to outsource that to corporations, and they do a fair enough job. But cooking seems different, even as we are outsourcing it increasingly. And rates of home cooking have declined dramatically since the 60s. We're still obsessed with it. We have a culture that fetishizes cooking. You know, we go to restaurants with open plans where you can watch the food be cooked. And we watch all these programs in prime time about cooking, competitive cooking shows. And it makes me wonder if we are quite ready to let it go, and that cooking is very powerful. We all have memories of being cooked for by loved ones, by our parents, by our grandparents. And the processes are kind of woven into our childhood still. And I think we miss it, actually, even as we tell ourselves we don't have time and we don't have skills.
So what exactly is the price to be paid when we outsource cooking ever more so often?
The price is tremendous. And you find, if you look at the statistics for the rise in obesity, it very closely tracks the decline in home cooking. And the reason for that is that corporations who cook for us today don't cook very well. I'm talking about fast food companies. I'm talking about the processors of, you know, ready meals and things like that, takeaway food. They tend to use the cheapest possible raw ingredients that they can get away with. Then they dress it up with lots of salt, fat, and sugar, which are three very inexpensive ingredients that we love. And when you combine those three primary colors, if you will, of flavor, food becomes addictive. And they understand this. The food is engineered to get us to eat more. And then the other thing corporate cooks do is they use lots of food additives, lots of chemicals that no ordinary human keeps in their pantry. And the reason for this is that very often the food has been cooked long ago and far away, and you need to disguise that fact with coloring and flavoring and emulsifiers and, you know, all sorts of things. And I'm sure you don't have any polysorbate 80 in your pantry at home or xanthan gum. But you need that when you're making processed food. So it's fundamentally a different kind of food that they make, and it tends to be a much more fattening, less healthy kind of food.
At the same time, have you noticed this tendency that even those corporate cooks are actually trying to think of healthier alternatives? Do you believe in them?
Yes and no. There are some cases where you find some companies trying to offer healthier alternatives. But by and large, health is a marketing strategy for food companies. To put a health claim on a food, like this is low fat or this is high in fiber, is basically tweaking the dial a little bit, re-engineering it very slightly, simply so you can make a claim. And what we find happens is as soon as you put a health claim on food, it becomes an excuse to eat a lot more of it. So, for example, when we re-engineered the whole food supply to be low fat in the 80s and 90s, and there was this explosion of fat-free ice cream and fat-free chips and fat-free everything, people gorged on carbohydrates. And we actually got quite fat during the low-fat campaign. So you have to be very careful of processed food companies selling health.
In principle, your book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, is quite an appraisal for the importance and significance of cooking at home. How do you think the world would change if people actually started doing that at home, as they used to say 50, 60 years ago?
Oh, a great many things would change for the better. I mean, one would be our health. I mean, the most important thing about your health, your dietary health, is who's doing the cooking? Is it a human being or is it a corporation? In terms of your family life, the family meal is a very important institution of civilization, of democracy, I would argue. It's at the table that we teach our children how to take turns, how to share, how to argue without fighting. They learn the arts of adult conversation at the table. It's the nursery of democracy. It's very closely tied to home cooking. If you are home cooking, you will sit down for a meal. You've done all that work, and you're not going to let the kids wander off to their bedrooms and their screens with whatever beautiful food you've made. Whereas if people are eating fast food, microwavable entrees, they're going to tend to eat alone and on the go. One of the things we've seen that since we've outsourced our cooking, we're doing a lot more of what the U.S. government calls secondary eating. This is eating while you're doing something else, eating while you're in the car, where Americans eat about 20% of their food today, eating on the run, eating while walking. I even saw a woman in New York last month who was eating and jogging at the same time. Quite a trick. And when you're doing that kind of secondary eating, the social meaning of food is lost. And it is only at the meals that the full power of food can really be experienced, you know, at the table with other people. Food is about so much more than fuel. It's a social medium. It's how we connect to friends and family and even enemies sit down. You know, you think about summit meetings. You get the leaders together and you feed them and you give them something to drink. And suddenly the ice is broken and people begin to connect.
Have you ever eaten and jogged at the same time?
I've never done that, I've got to admit. I don't know if I could pull it off.
I'm fascinated by the logistics of that.
But there is definitely a lot of truth in what he's saying, isn't it?
Huge amount.
That stat, 20% of Americans eat 20% of their meals in cars,
yeah,
while driving. That's astounding, isn't it?
Well, I've done an awful lot of plastic sandwiches in cars, and it's a soulless experience. But I am now going to try and experiment the eating while dining.
You were saying yesterday you had a home-cooked meal, but it wasn't... It felt home-cooked, but it wasn't necessarily...
It felt home-cooked, but it was... wasn't really. It was one of those places where it was a convivial family meal, but it was predominantly out of a packet, sadly. No, it wasn't out of a packet. It was fresh cooked, but I didn't do it. And it felt homely until I suddenly looked at what quite a hollow experience it was. It tasted nice, though.
Well, that's all that counts. And of course, you can catch more of the menu tonight with Marcus Hippie at 1900 hours London time.
This is Midori House. In the next and final half hour of today's programme, we'll get the latest news from our man in Madrid, and we'll wonder if more and more people will be taking their clothes off on screen in the near future. But with the time at 30 minutes past
Barney's
the hour...
confused again.
I'm keeping my clothes on.
Thank you, Barney. We'd be most appreciative. If you wouldn't mind, though, could you oblige us with the headlines?
Certainly, Emma. Thank you. Russian, US and UN officials are to meet next week to discuss ways to bring the warring sides in Syria together for a peace conference. The meeting, proposed by Washington and Moscow, is under threat as the different factions lay down demands before talks take place. And US and UK officials are investigating unconfirmed reports that an American woman and a British man have been killed in Syria. Authorities in the US say they've intercepted a threatening letter addressed to President Obama, similar to ones recently sent to New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Those letters contain material believed to be the deadly poison ricin. The European Union has agreed to put an end to decades of overfishing and rebuild dwindling stocks by 2020. It's part of a deal to overhaul the bloc's fisheries policy. A team of researchers try to solve the mystery of the disappearance of the aviator Amelia Earhart in 1937 say a sonar image taken from just beyond the shore of a remote Pacific island could be a piece of wreckage from her plane. And a 13-year-old boy from Bayside Hills, New York, has won the Scripps National Spelling Bee by correctly spelling knadel, a kind of dumpling. Arvind Mahankali had finished third in the contest twice before, each time stumbling on German words. But this time, he nailed it with knadel. There's the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. Barney will be back at the top of the hour to bring you the full roundup of what's going on in the world. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where the time in Madrid is at 9:32 a.m., which is where we head now to get the latest Spanish business news.
And joining us on the line from Madrid is our man there, Liam Aldis. Welcome to the show, Liam. Happy Friday. Some sad news, perhaps, though, for the king. He's had to hand over something quite special to him, perhaps.
Yeah, times are tough. I feel very sorry for the king. He's actually had to hand over his 21 million euro yacht back. He's actually handed it back to the government, even though they didn't give it to him. It was actually a gift 13 years ago from a big bunch of business groups on the Balearic Islands and the Balearic government. And they hoped to, they gave him the yacht to bring him to the island so it would be good for tourism. So there's a lot of hotel groups and tourism oriented businesses who gave him this yacht, and they're up in arms because they want their money back. They paid 600,000 euros each to get the king to come there every summer. He did come for 13 years, but they want their money back. They don't care that he's giving it back to the government in the good interest of the Spanish crisis to give the government a bit of money. They want their money back in their own pockets.
Liam, it does seem like a rather strange thing to give to a government because there is that strange adage which says that the only 2 days when you're happy when you are a yacht owner are the day you take delivery of it and the day you get rid of it. These things cost an awful lot of money to maintain. Is anybody getting the impression that Juan Carlos is handing over something which is rather costly and he doesn't want to be lumbered with?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, actually, because if you look at the costs, even the maintenance costs, and it costs about 20,000 euros just to fill up the fuel tank. So, I mean, yeah, there are a lot of costs. But if you actually look into the issue a bit more, he actually has a lot of other yacht options. He's actually he's really good friends with a big shipbuilder called José Cusí. So he actually doesn't really spend much time on this yacht. Last year, he only took it out for about 6 hours last August. So I don't think he's going to really miss it. I think maybe he's just trying to get rid of a few of the assets that are just crowding his boat shed.
Well, you said it was good news for the Balearic residents because obviously it helped a bit with tourism there. Any plans that they might pitch in and perhaps buy the king a new, maybe a smaller yacht perhaps?
I don't think so. They're in a bit of financial strife themselves. That's probably why they want their money back. But I think if you look at behind all this, the king's obviously trying to make it look like he's tightening the purse strings a little, because the monarchy is in a bit of a problem at the moment with public opinion. They're only rated about 3.6 out of 10 for trust, which is the lowest score they've ever got on any of the polls. So even last night, the Crown Prince and his wife Letizia were booed at the opera. So it's not looking good when even the opera crowd is booing you.
Yeah, it's trouble indeed, actually, isn't it? Liam, move on to the world of politics, if you would. That there is a veiled swipe has been made at Prime Minister Rajoy by someone who really should have gone by now.
Ex-Prime Minister Aznar, who was... two prime ministers back in the chronology of prime ministers. He actually made a very highly publicised TV interview a week and a half ago on Tuesday night. And he's actually, yeah, he criticised the government in a kind of roundabout, ambiguous way. The whole interview was actually kind of torturous to watch because it was so ambiguous. He was kind of like had this sly kind of smile the whole time, and he wasn't really answering anything directly. And he kind of alluded to the fact that he would be willing to come back to politics to save the country because he just feels like the country is going down the gurgler and his former protege, Rajoy, who's now Prime Minister, isn't really doing a good job, which is quite interesting because he's criticising his own party and he's still the honorary president of his party. So it was caused a big furor in the country, and all the past Prime Ministers came out of the woodwork to give their opinions on whether he should have said what he said. And former Prime Minister Zapatero said he would never criticise Rajoy. That's just not what he does. And then someone from the PP said, oh, well, Zapatero has finally concreted his role as the best ex-Prime Minister Spain ever had, because they always call him the worst Prime Minister.
And he does have the facts, though, to back up his case. Spain's economy just was released, the latest figures yesterday, saying that the economy shrank for a seventh consecutive quarter. It's expected the economy is going to decline by some 1.3% this year. Unemployment is 27%. More than half of young Spaniards are out of work. It's tough going for the economy, and especially for the government.
It's definitely tough going, but Rajoy has come out and said that they're going to stay firm, they're going to keep with their reform agenda, they're not going to waver even when they get criticism from the highest echelons of the party. But when the best quote that came out of this whole episode was the ex-Prime Minister Felipe González, who said that if he wants to come back, then let him come back, but he feels uncomfortable with the fact that he feels that he needs to come, or he feels obliged to come back to save the country. And he kind of made this, then provided this kind of metaphor, and said he's kind of like a large Chinese vase. He'd be like a large Chinese vase in a small apartment. You can attribute value to it, but it just gets in the way. So wise words there from Felipe González.
It does feel like personality politics is really getting in the way, though, of some quite profound problems which need addressing. Let's move on to another item that you wanted to draw our attention to, Liam, which is quite an astonishing effort to generate income to the country by trying to get around smoking laws.
Yeah, this is a news item. This keeps popping up because it's just so ridiculous, for lack of a better word. It's the big Eurovegas casino project, which Barcelona and Madrid were battling each other for the last 5 years. Madrid finally won the project, and to get the project, they have suggested to Sheldon Adelson, the big casino magnate, that they would be willing to change the anti-smoking law to allow people to smoke on the casino floor, which has everyone up in everyone kind of quite angry, especially small businesses who are receiving fines for people smoking in bars. It's a €5,000 fine if you're caught with people smoking on your premises. But the government is defending the change of the law, saying they need to do anything they can to get employment back to Spain. So they're kind of desperate. It's kind of indicative of the desperation the government has, that they're willing to change laws. Even the health minister is supporting employment over the health of passive smokers. It's quite funny.
Indeed, it is, Liam. As ever, thank you very much indeed. That was Liam Aldous, Monocle's man in Madrid. The time is just nudging 39 minutes past the hour, and you're with Midori House.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here at, in Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn. The time is coming up to 40 minutes past the hour. And now here is the item that Barney Burnham, our newsreader at least, has been bracing himself for. Because could sex be making a comeback to our cinema screens?
Don't look at me.
I'm not. But by all accounts, the average cinema goer has been deprived of a decent celluloid knee trembler for some time because Hollywood has decided to keep it zipped. Europe, however, has always taken a more liberal, perhaps grown-up view of sex on screen. For example, 6 years ago, the EU launched a campaign to boost its appeal by editing together the continent's naughtiest bits on films and therefore claiming that this is what everyone in Brussels is getting up to. It was a touch unconvincing for anyone who's seen it, but you've got to give them a few marks out of 10 for effort at least.
It's not the reason why I moved to the UK, though.
Isn't it?
No.
Well, not in the United Kingdom. Hop over to Europe. Mainland Europe, and it's a very different story.
And this year, the Palme d'Or winner in Cannes contained a full 10 minutes of explicit sex. Oh, my. So with this and, please God, no, a forthcoming adaptation of 50 Shades of Grey, are we all to enjoy a spot of good old-fashioned loving on our screens again? Are you ready for that?
Yes.
Are you?
Obviously.
Obviously.
Always.
Well, Monocle's blushing innocent researcher, I'm not sure about that, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke to our film critic and regular, Karen Krasanovich, if sex is still a selling point for films.
Let's start with the winning film this year in the Cannes Film Festival, La Vie d'Adèle.
Leave my heart. En fait, si tu veux, tout ça, ça n'a pas beaucoup d'importance. En fait, il a fait une petite révolution intellectuelle qui a eu pour mérite de libérer toute une génération.
There's quite a lot of sex in it, right, Karen? Sorry for this, my first question.
Well, there is. There is a lot of sex in it. Ebba the Leaf Kichichi, I hope I'm saying his name correctly, in his 175 minutes of this explicit lesbian love story, has a 12-minute scene with no holds barred. As far as lesbian sex goes. And people seem to be quite astonished by this, but it didn't stop the film from winning. And I also don't think that's the reason why the film won, but I think it's a conglomerate of making the film more powerful. It's part of the story, much as sex is part of all of our lives. It's part of our story, too. And it's a very mature way of looking at it, I think.
And that's quite interesting. I mean, in Cannes, I wonder why they are shocked because, you know, there's always so many scandals at the festival. Were there any other films with sexual content this year?
Cannes always has something controversial, whether it's weirdness or violence or sex, for that matter. There were a couple of films like Grand Central had nuclear power plant employees having sex on their time off. Young and Beautiful focuses on a 16-year-old who, after having her first sexual encounter, decides to become a prostitute. I guess if you're beautiful, it makes life a little easier. There's always been a lot of sex in films at Cannes, but also a lot of sex off screen. For example, walking up the red carpet this year, particularly with there was immense torrential rain and a lot of wind, which seems to be getting worse and worse every year. In fact, several starlets were caught unawares that the wind would lift up even the longest dress. Oh. So there was some exposure there. I suppose not sex particularly, but as a noun, yes.
If you're wondering why I'm asking so many questions about sex in films, is there any resurgence of sex? Because I know we've been discussing this earlier on, that Hollywood is becoming quite conservative. I haven't seen a sex scene in all these blockbusters. And there's even an interesting note, you know, Christopher Nolan, which is one of the most acclaimed directors nowadays, there's not a single sex scene in all of his films.
That's a very interesting point you make with Christopher Nolan, because we have the wife and the children. Where's that step in between? Okay, never mind. But yes, you're absolutely right. There was a recent study, 2009, saying that between box office and critical success, that sex was not important for the American cinema. In fact, it had a bias against profit. So they've taken that on board. It's not just that. Hollywood has always had problems with sex, always. There was the Hays Code that came in. I can't remember the exact year, but anything before Hays Code was quite raunchy, actually, quite risque, even today. And after that, everything kind of, you know, they had to have a foot on the floor when they were kissing and the beds have to be separate. But sex is such an important part of everybody's life. We're interested in it, even long after we've had it ourselves or even before we've had it. It's also, I think, a life force, and that's why people are perennially interested. So in a European cinema, or in fact a global cinema, sex will always return. And I think that you're right. This year particularly, sex has come back in somewhat less sensational fashion, but just as important. So in a way, in 2013, we're looking at Cannes and various other festivals and film releases this year, that sex is something that we're no longer sneaking off to see like we're, you know, 16 or 14 or something and thinking, ooh, I wonder what happens. Because thanks to, you know, online, well, thanks or no thanks to being online, children are much more sexually aware, and people not sure that that's good or bad. But we're taking sex as a more normal thing, I think.
Shall we talk about, I mean, another film in this year's festival, Behind the Candelabra?
Yes.
Can you tell me? I mean, oh. that's I know you've seen it and you
I
loved it, right?
I love that film. I love it. Okay, if you've seen Basic Instinct, you'll remember there was a scene where you got to see Michael Douglas's bottom really clearly. And everybody was complaining, well, a lot of my friends were complaining, that it wasn't a pretty bottom. It wasn't what they wanted in their cinematic bottoms.
Oh, God.
And the Michael Douglas's same bottom is back. It's just as flat as it was before. But he's here, and it's a really interesting look at mature sexuality, gay sexuality, well, male sexuality anyway. He's naked in it quite a bit, in a bubble bath or under the sheets. Of course, he's playing Liberace, and Matt Damon is his younger lover. And it's explicit, but it's also intimate. And it's kind of shocking, but it's also sort of normal. And it's very interesting. I don't want to ruin it, but okay, spoiler alert. He admits to having had some sexual enhancements done. Liberace, and you're thinking, Liberace, you goat.
And, you know, you mentioned Basic Instinct. There was a time, like the late 80s, early 90s, there was quite a few films like Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct, Nine and a Half Weeks of Love. And do you think this might come back somehow? Because I wonder if Hollywood would put such a big budget on a film like this.
I don't think so. I mean, not as such, because back in the 80s, pornography and nudity was harder to get a hold of. It was more titillating. But I think what's happening now is that we're looking at sex. If Hollywood is going to invest in sex, it's going to be very, very careful how it's marketed. Now, people don't realize, and I say this again and again, that Hollywood is in trouble, that movies are not its mainstream for finance. And it takes a lot of money to run a studio. So what's happening in Hollywood is that they're making films that the whole family can go and see. Something that's exciting. Something
safe.
Exactly. Something that won't alienate younger viewers. Sex, maybe not so good. I mean, you know, when I was, you know, that age, I probably would have enjoyed watching some sex on the screen. But, you know, superheroes, that kind of thing. And people feel that that's okay because it's just one step up from comic books. I do think, though, that sex isn't going to come back like it was in the 80s because we have a different attitude toward it now. It's no longer mysterious. It's something that we want to still see, but we want to see it in a different kind of context.
And talking about sex in Hollywood, what about 50 Shades of Grey? That's potentially a blockbuster, and they can't escape from sex.
That's a very good point. My heavens, you surprised me.
Yeah. See?
Well, they haven't cast it yet. They've still been talking about it. You're absolutely right. 50 Shades is going to be a real blockbuster because they're going to have to be very careful how they shoot it, what they show, and I suspect, as they have with most films, like Nymphomaniac, for example, and Basic Instinct and other films, they're probably going to have a safe version and a not-so-safe version. So I think that's how they'll approach it. Whether they're going to go as far as explicit pornographic sex, or let's take that back and say European-style sex, where people aren't going to get all excited, I'm not quite sure, because it's still a Hollywood movie.
But overall, Karen, sex still sells, no?
I think so. You know, I was thinking about this on the way over. Does sex still sell globally? Personally, I think people are always going to be interested. Whether they say so at a dinner party is another thing.
Great. And I would like to end our interview with a quote from the lovely film Basic Instinct.
Great.
Would you tell us the nature of your relationship with Mr. Boz?
I had sex with him for about a year and a half. I liked having sex with him. He wasn't afraid of experimenting. I like men like that. Men who give me pleasure. He gave me a lot of pleasure.
Wow.
Phil, you've gone really uncomfortable there.
That was really awkward.
That was slightly awkward because I actually thought that that was Karen Krasanovich for just a moment. Because they had very similar voices and my concentration lapsed ever so slightly with the arrival of our paper reviewer, David Michon, who's just arrived.
A man who's had no sexual enhancements.
I wouldn't know.
I don't know.
I wonder whether we should ask
Maybe
him on air, Phil. Perhaps not, hey.
Yeah. Well, that was indeed our very innocent, but perhaps not so innocent anymore, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, speaking there with our film critic, Karen Krasanovich. Now, we're going to have a look at the Canadian front pages in just a moment, but before we do, here is the appropriately titled song Sexy by the French singer Saez.
Mes talents goûtent, tu sais, non, ne t'arrête pas, continue de lécher, que j'aime quand tu fais ça, en totale mission. Dans de toi-même, fais monter l'excitation pour l'amour et la haine. Ça fait du mal.
And for those francophones among the listeners, you may be wishing to avert your ears now. That was Sex by Saez.
You speak French.
I do.
Do you care to fill us in on a bit of the translation? Or
possibly not, no. It's not so bad. It's not so bad, no. Not so bad. Anyway, right. David Michon, you're here to rescue us with today's Canadian papers.
Hello.
Let's go from...
that was a really energetic... Fernando, was that a choice by Fernando?
Of course it
always
was.
Always a very energetic
It's a little
selection.
Bit dark and dirty, is Faye. Yeah. He gives the impression of being lighter than light, and then he offers us one of those. Thanks, Faye. David, take us to the world of Rob Ford.
Oh, my God. Rob Ford. Who is this man?
Oh, well, there's a lot
He's
of him.
He's our mayor. Charles Mayor.
So, obviously, for those of you who somehow miraculously haven't heard about Rob Ford yet, he is Toronto's mayor who has been accused of smoking crack in a video that appeared... how long ago was it?
Two weeks ago.
Some journalists were allowed to see it. You know, Gawker had crowdsourced $200,000 and tried to figure out a way to get it to a drug dealer illegally to then get the video, et cetera. Yesterday, two more of his staff, quit.
Who's he got left now? I mean, he's lost five in the last week.
He's got his brother.
yes, which the Globe and Mail had a few choice things to say about.
Of course, there's also allegations that his entire family, the other members of his family are also involved.
And not particularly palatable characters,
should we
say that.
So now the newest of the new news is that the Ontario Premier, Kathleen Wynne, of the Liberal Party, she has now said that she may choose to intervene into city politics because she is concerned about his actions. Not so much his actions, I guess, so much as how much those allegations have taken up, the airwaves and the column inches and the focus of city council. So, I mean, on top of it being really incredibly bad branding for Toronto and Canada, it's also... totally a fixation.
But it is amazing, though, after 2 weeks and the constant attention that's been on this man.
Well,
he's still in the job.
Yes, of course. And this comes, several months after he was actually removed from his post for completely separate reasons and reinstated.
And I quite like this take by the Globe and Mail because for the last forever how long, the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star in particular, have been waging war against Rob Ford. This has been, it is very personal.
Yes.
It is now quite nice, perhaps, to see the Globe and Mail taking a slightly longer view in terms of how does Toronto get out of this mess? Because for the last 2 weeks, we've just seen them fling mud.
Yeah.
And then you see one voice that says, hang on a minute, Brand Toronto is being really badly damaged by this. We need a conciliatory approach. Whether this woman, it's Kathleen Wynne, whether Kathleen Wynne is actually the right woman for the job, who knows? I mean, she's a brave girl if she wants to take it on.
Of course. I mean, aside from how kind of, at least from way over here, it's a bit funny. I mean, obviously, you know, it's almost unimaginable. But it is obviously a really serious issue for the city of Toronto, and for the, you know, provincial premier to say, okay, well, maybe I'm going to have to do something about this, and I'm going to have to use some kind of powers, you know.
Which would be unprecedented as well for an Ontario premier to do something like that in such a large city in Canada. But what's interesting is, as you mentioned, there are some serious issues that Toronto really needs to deal with. You know, I'm from Toronto and I know that the transit system there is a complete and utter mess. They've been trying to work out the system in some way, but it hasn't essentially been in deadlock. And now they're trying to work out details of this $34 billion transit building plan, but no one's talking about it. No one's working on it.
Of course. Obviously, transit has been a huge issue for Toronto for many years, and with varying kind of, you know, difficult relationships between the national government, who's agreed to contribute money, the provincial government, and the city mayor, and you know, it seems like just at the point when something will happen and investment will actually be made, then they totally get off track, and so maybe this is the next kind of addition of the Toronto transit woes. But yes, they are kind of, this is a time when they were meant to be working out a deal.
So, what have you got next?
I'm going to stay cities, actually, because that's my beat.
And you're off to the cities conference in Sao Paulo, yes. Brazil, next week, aren't you?
So I just thought it was, British Columbia, scooting over to the west coast of Canada, has a new auditor general, and she said that her first task will be to look into the spending by city governments. So I just think this is quite interesting because, you know, we often talk about spending at a federal level and a provincial level because those have been seen to be kind of the more important levels of government. And so for a provincial auditor general to say, actually, you know, what we need to focus on now is how our cities are run, is kind of an interesting step in terms of the life of these cities and kind of the importance of cities in, you know, the context of a provincial or federal environment. So
we had a guest on the Monocle Daily who was arguing that effectively the United States needs a wholesale reform of the way that cities are run, and most importantly is the transport infrastructure, as is the education. And we did examine the rather fundamental issue of trains in America, and how perhaps they could do with a little bit of attention.
Well, we have time for just one more story that I really want to get to, because we've been talking about sex all program, and there's one story here about French
all
kissing.
Program.
Yes,
well,
French
yes,
kissing.
I wanted to bring that up.
Oh, good Lord.
Okay, so apparently I didn't know this, but this is from the Associated Press, which appears in the Toronto Star, and it is about the word for French kissing in French, which didn't exist. Or wasn't used. So now it's in the Robert French Dictionary now, and it is galocher.
Galocher. Sexy.
Doesn't sound sloppy.
It does sound sloppy.
Well, sloppy.
There's nothing worse. Thank you very much indeed, David Michon.
And thanks to our producer, Annabelle Bly, and Barbara Feeney. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Marcus Hippie and myself will be back with Rory House at the same time on Monday. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Emma Nelson.
It's bye-bye.
Thank you for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.